I'm very proud and honored to endorse Howard Dean to be the next president of the United States of America.
That was, of course, former Vice President Al Gore in Harlem this morning endorsing former Vermont Governor Howard Dean for the Democratic presidential ticket. What impact is this going to have on the Democratic presidential race? We're going to deal with that question here in the first segment of Issues Etc. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Walls of Concordia University in Wisconsin. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be spending some time talking with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. We'll get our religion roundup with him. We'll talk about liturgical reform and the latest in his series on Islam. We'll talk about women in Islam. Hopefully during this program today, we'll be talking with Dr. Ed Kettner of Concordia Luther Seminary in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. There's a social divide growing, at least according to the paper, between Canadians and Americans. That'll be a subject for a little bit later. During open lines, a little monkey see, monkey do. Why is it that in pop culture, we are subjected every night, whether you watch the networks or whether you watch cable, to imitations and knockoffs of things we've seen before? Last night, I watched the final episode, or at least the final few minutes of the final episode, of a show called Average Joe. It looked a lot to me like Joe Millionaire or any of the other hookup shows that have been on television for the last 2 or 3 years. Indistinguishable in a lot of ways. The premise, very similar. Why is it that pop culture and Hollywood can't produce anything new? It's just monkey see, monkey do. And why is it that the church is following suit? We'll talk about that during Open Lines, Issues, etc. Plus some news from Fuller Theological Seminary. They consider themselves the cutting edge of evangelical thought. What are they saying? We're not going to proselytize Muslims anymore. We don't need to. Why? We worship the same God. That's out of Fuller. We'll talk about that during Open Lines. And then, in the last half hour of the program, Dr. Daryl Charles joins us of Baylor University. He has written an extensive article in Touchstone Magazine about just war theory. That'll be the subject for the last half hour of Issues Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Earlier today, Vice President Al Gore endorsed Vermont Governor Howard Dean for president. We'll find out what the impact of that is going to be right now. Dr. Jeff Walls is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, a regular guest here on Issues Etc. Dr. Walls, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be back.
And congratulations are in order, I understand?
Yes. First child, Matthew Henry, was born on Saturday, so we're very excited about that gift from God.
Well, congratulations to you and to your wife as well.
Thank you.
Let's talk about what happened this morning. What was this event intended to say about Howard Dean from Gore's perspective, and what was it intended to say about former Vice President Al Gore?
Well, I think for Dean, it's clearly an indication that Dean wants to be seen by the Democratic Party and by more moderate Democratic voters as one of them. The great fear that some within the party, the Democratic Party, had was Dean would be in some ways like a Goldwater, the Republican in 64, who ran on a fairly conservative platform and agenda and who lost a very lopsided race in 64. And so primarily what I think Dean wanted this to accomplish was to demonstrate not only now in the upcoming primary and caucus season, but also potentially if he were to emerge down the road in the general election season, that he's not as quote-unquote extreme or left or liberal as some would like to think. And in fact, he is closer to some of Al Gore's positions, who people would say would be more moderate Democratic in some ways. From Gore's perspective, it's a little more difficult to exactly read that. For a while now, Gore, as we know, has kept a fairly low profile. He's, until recently, kept out of the spotlight, kept out of the news, was not very critical of Bush early on. This either, I think, signals Gore wanting to demonstrate that he still has power within the party, still has a certain panache, or it's really, if you take it at face value, as I watched just a small clip or a brief clip of the press conference to which you alluded, a sense that Gore is really excited about Dean's campaign and really is excited about the grassroots enthusiasm and the grassroots energy that Dean seems to be energizing.
The obvious question that comes up, I think, first is, what about Joe Lieberman, who was Vice President Gore's running mate in 2000 for the presidential ticket? Lieberman would have been the vice president. Why was there no endorsement from Gore of Lieberman, and what reaction has there been from Lieberman?
Yeah, that's a very interesting situation. Lieberman had said a while back that he would not run this time in 04 until he knew for sure that Al Gore was not going to run again in 04. And some within the Lieberman camp said that really hamstrung him, Lieberman, that he didn't get his campaign, his agenda off the ground like he wanted to, because he had to wait so long for Gore to decide not to enter the race in 04. What this does for Lieberman is it really takes a potential Trump card out of his hand. So there was some thinking that down the road, had Lieberman stayed close or done well, especially after New Hampshire and Iowa, which was and remains his strategy, that Gore may have decided to jump in at that point and endorse Lieberman and bolster his campaign. Exactly why this occurred and why Gore did not support Lieberman, probably a couple of reasons. One, both of these politicians have very different perspectives on the war and on Iraq. On the one hand, Lieberman has supported President Bush's execution, or if not execution, at least move to Iraq and an actual invasion, while, of course, taking some umbrage with the execution or with how the policy was implemented, especially after the war. Whereas Al Gore has been much more like Dean and been very critical of not only the war itself, but especially of how Bush has executed it. So very different perspectives in some ways on the war. And also, we may recall that after 2000, after that a very prolonged account and Supreme Court decision, Lieberman came out and was somewhat critical of how Gore had run his campaign, suggesting that had Gore run more as a moderate Democrat, engaged in less discussion about taxes and the rich versus the poor, had Gore been more of a centrist candidate, that potentially Gore could have won in 2000. And so those are just a couple of reasons why there's at least a semi-rift between these two camps.
What effect is the Gore endorsement of Dean going to have on the Democratic primaries, and will that effect, if any, be able to extend all the way to the 2004 election?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly could, Todd, extend all the way to the 2004 election. It seems to me initially this endorsement will have some effect in New Hampshire, the first primary, although not a tremendous effect at this point. And even before this endorsement, Dean had held a pretty comfortable lead over Kerry in New Hampshire. Iowa could be a different story, where Dean had been doing quite well. Missouri's own Gephardt, of course, had been doing well. This might hurt Gephardt. Gore tended to run well in Iowa. He was well respected in Iowa. So the Gephardt camp, I've read and seems to be concerned more, certainly since they're focusing on Iowa, about the effect in Iowa and how this could give Dean even greater catapulting capacity. Now, after these first two contests, New Hampshire and Iowa, certainly Dean's hope here is to use Gore's residence, his southern residence, and his charming effect, if that's not too strong, on some African-American and black voters in the South. That was one concern where Dean, as we may recall, had stumbled a few times in trying to address how to win southern votes during not only a primary season or caucus season, but certainly during the general election. So I think this helps Dean out, certainly in the short term, but also longer term, as we get past New Hampshire and Iowa and some of these early southern primary states, where the Gore endorsement, I think, will carry some weight.
I certainly understand the second point there, that being that former Vice President Al Gore polls very well with African Americans. They made this announcement in Harlem. There's some obvious symbolism there, I believe, as well. But the first point is a little puzzling, because former Vice President Al Gore was unable to carry even his own state in the 2000 elections, wasn't he? Does he really have any power to carry any states with an endorsement?
Well, yeah, that's well taken. Power may have been a strong term, but more of a Southern presence may be one way to look at it. One thing that certainly Dean is focused on and Gore is focused on is trying to win the South and trying to win Southern votes on a more, you might say, traditional Democratic agenda. So rather than talking taxes, rather than talking guns, rather than talking morality, quote-unquote, what Dean hopes to do and what Gore certainly supports is to focus on more traditional Democratic values and issues like education, like health care, like women's issues that perhaps could give Dean a little more traction, at least a little more believability in the South, even though, as you said, Gore's had his own problems in his backyard.
So this is about crafting the message for Howard Dean. Now, it's commonly understood that in primaries, presidential candidates play largely to their base, to the most secure voters they have in their pockets. But after the primaries, everyone kind of starts over again. How is the message of Howard Dean likely to look after the primaries as opposed to going into the primaries?
Well, yes, after the primaries, as you said, candidates of both the left and the right do run, as it were, to the center to try to appear and try to be more moderate in the general election. Certainly I think Gore helps Dean with Democratic voters, helps him with voters who might want at least a semblance of the Clinton centrist ideology back, this Democratic Leadership Council that said, let's move beyond the party's base, let's become more moderate, let's become more centrist as a means to win elections and at least initiate some of our policies. So it seems in the short term that would be helpful. However, Dean has also, of course, been anti-war and anti-tax cuts. And, you know, in the South and certainly in the West and Midwest, this message will be difficult to backtrack upon. We could see one possibility I've heard is Dean recasting himself a bit if he were to make it past the primaries, focusing more on the conduct of the war than on the initiation of the war itself, and perhaps shying away from some of his criticism of the tax cuts by the Bush administration. And I guess the real question is, can Dean move to the center without losing the great energy and the enthusiasm and the initiative that the base of his party, that the more liberal base of the Democratic Party has given him? So there is, as you suggested, this balancing act where Dean will need to run to the center to try and be competitive. And yet, on the other hand, it's difficult to do that without losing some of this base that, quite frankly, has put Dean in the situation and position he's in right now.
He has raised a lot of his money by positioning himself as not only left of center, but pretty far left of the rest of the candidates against whom he is competing in the Democratic primary.
Right, exactly. And that's why you look at somebody like Lieberman. Again, I can't look inside of his head or certainly his campaign's head, but there were some fears inside that camp that we don't want to be too liberal, because then it would appear that we were simply being opportunistic in recasting ourselves for the general election. So Lieberman's strategy, it seems to me, was to be a moderate, to be a centrist, and somehow emerge through the primaries and caucuses, and I think be a viable opponent to President Bush. Now, if Dean were to make it through to the next round, to the general election, it would be difficult. The math is certainly favoring Bush electorally if or when we talk about the general election, we look at states that won or gained and lost seats due to the latest reapportionment, and you see Bush and the Republicans coming out ahead in that electoral math. So the Democrats, in essence, in 04, the general election will already start behind the eight ball. If the election were held today, and the same states voted the same way that they did in 2000, Bush, of course, would still win, but he'd win by a larger majority or a larger margin in the Electoral College. So it's difficult for the Democrats, given the electoral math, to win, especially with a candidate who, as you said, has been more beholden to his more liberal base.
Dr. Jeff Walz is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. We're talking about the impact of Vice President Al Gore's endorsement today of former Vermont Governor Howard Dean for the Democratic presidential race. You mentioned before the reapportionment, and that raised in my mind the recent election in California and the changing of hands of the governorship there from Gray Davis to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Will that have any impact on who has a better shot at California in 2004?
Very good question, Todd. Two schools of thought here. Some Republican insiders, some operatives who study these things closely, while certainly they respect Schwarzenegger, in a sense would have preferred to see Gray Davis remain in California as governor. And primarily that's because there was a sense at that point prior to this special election in October that things would not get better much sooner in California. And generally, voters, when they go to the polls, will look at their pocketbooks and, in part, use that as a means of their vote, a means of directing their votes. And so under that scenario, it might have been better to have Gray Davis in office as a Republican candidate, because then the Republican Party could say, well, you know, Davis has not improved things. Things are still going downhill. It's time for a change. And certainly part of that change or part of that continuity on the national level would be President Bush. The thing now with Schwarzenegger as governor and the economy getting a little better, this seems at this point at least to bode well for the Republicans in California. Now, still though, the odds of Bush winning in California in November 04 would still be quite slim today. But the real question is how much energy, how many dollars, how many people will the Democrats, whether that be Dean, Lieberman, Gephardt, or whomever, will they need to extend in California to make sure they win those electoral votes? Because if it's fairly one-sided for the Democrats in the presidential race, then that will allow them to use resources in other states and help them to at least counter that math, electoral math problem to which I referred. So,
and on that subject, mm-hmm. It's important to note that very recently Howard Dean announced that he would not be accepting federal funds after the primary, mm-hmm. so that he could pursue the larger money. And he said he simply had to do it because George W. Bush mm-hmm. had already raised so much.
Right, right. And, yeah, exactly. And the Bush campaign, we can look at issues and we can look at different areas of agendas, but as you say, looking at the money that can be used for advertising, get out the vote initiatives, and so on, Bush, by foregoing the funds as well, and with such a fairly late Labor Day, September, New York campaign, first weekend of September, this allows then Bush to really use many funds and use a majority of funds in a short period of time before November to I think, effectively lock out a Democratic candidate financially. So, yeah, exactly. Dean, looking down the road, is trying to position himself financially as well.
A couple more very quick questions. First of all, former vice president has laid in his endorsement for president in 2004. Can we expect former President Clinton to lay in an official endorsement for anyone in the Democratic Party for 2004?
Good question. there was quite a bit of speculation about Wesley Clark, and certainly Clinton has spoken very highly of him. There are certainly some similarities in outlook and issues and perspective between these two politicians. Clinton, like Gore, had been lying fairly low in the weeds, wanting the process to move forward without them. We know, of course, Clinton loves the limelight. So this is possible that Clinton might come out and support Clark. However, this Gore move may have preempted that and may have put Dean in such an untenable uncontested, I should say, position that that Clinton may feel it's best politically and pragmatically not to come out and endorse anyone, even, for example, his perhaps favorite candidate, General Clark.
Now, two Lieberman questions. The first one, about a month ago, he decided that and announced that he would not be going into the Iowa caucuses. He wasn't going to make a big effort there. Why is this so? It seems as though that's an important initial primary.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I guess a couple of things. One, going back to his deference to the former Vice President Al Gore, Lieberman was not able to get his campaign set, and his people could not get his campaign set in Iowa and New Hampshire as quickly and as sure-footedly as they would have liked to. So one answer we're hearing is that is because Lieberman had to wait so long for Gore to announce he would not run, this really put Lieberman behind the other candidates. And I think, too, when you look down the electoral road map, you look at Iowa, we think of it as a fairly conservative state, and it is in many ways. However, in this caucus, we're going to have a fairly small turnout, but a fairly liberal turnout among Democrats. So I think also Lieberman is saying, secondly, I really don't want to give the impression that I was going to put a lot of energy into Iowa especially and then fall flat on my face or not do as well as expectations. This way he can suggest, and his camp can suggest, well, we didn't have any expectations for Iowa, so any votes we might get is frosting on the cake. And also it allows him to put more resources down the road where some people think the real decision will come. And of course, this was before the Gore endorsement of Dean. So I think it was strategic, too, in looking at the primary and the caucus map.
Then finally, we only have about 15 seconds. Does Dean have it wrapped up with this endorsement?
I don't think he has it wrapped up. One thing I worry about Dean, and this is as a political observer, is he's getting better on the stump, but he still kind of shoots from the hip, and he could shoot from the hip and say something that could get him in some more hot water. So I don't think he has it wrapped up, but certainly this gives him more than a leg up.
Dr. Jeff Walls, thank you very much for being our guest. Congratulations on little Matthew Henry.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be here.
Dr. Jeff Walls, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, discussing several political issues there. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Why did the real St. Nicholas give out gifts? Who was Nicholas? When and where did he live? And why does the real story of the real St. Nicholas tell us more about Christ than about Kris Kringle? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December is the children's book, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. In this book, the real story of St. Nicholas is beautifully illustrated and simply told. You can order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend, by Julie Stiegelmeyer.
And now this Global Minute focuses your prayers on the Philippines at Christmas time. This woman says the focus is on food, going to church Christmas Eve and Christmas morning, and giving gifts, which include money.
We go to church again, and then we go to our neighbors, to our grandparents, and then kiss their hands. That is one of the basic tradition in the Philippines. We bow to them, and in return, they're giving us aguinaldos, or money, gifts, in return.
There's a spiritual struggle in the Philippines, which is tied into local politics. Some provinces want their freedom, and they even want to become an Islamic state. Some pastors and their families must battle poverty and a lack of resources, even a lack of Bibles. Pray for Filipino families to commit themselves to serving Jesus Christ. The Global Minute is a service of this station and the missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Last August, South Dakota Congressman William Janklow sped through a rural intersection, hit and killed a man on a motorcycle. His lawyers argued that he blacked out in a diabetic reaction. So why didn't he eat to avoid that reaction? I've asked myself that 10 million times, Janklow said. He wants to meet with the victim's family. I have to meet with them, he said, crying. As little children, we learned that Santa is making his list, checking it twice, going to find out who's naughty and nice. As we get older, most of us keep, close to our hearts, a list of things we feel guilty about. We would like to think that the nice things we've done outweigh the naughty things, but not before God. Psalm 143 says, "Do not bring your servant into judgment, for no one living is righteous before you." God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. John 3:17. Some people are not sensitive to their guilt. But most people you'll meet today secretly nurse their painful list of personal guilt. What will you put in their stocking? Coal or a kind word? I'm Dale Meyer.
In Luke chapter 17, the apostles turn to Jesus and they say, "Lord, increase our faith." Have you ever wanted to increase the faith that you have? How do we do that? Let's ask Pastor John Schmidtke next time on The Bible Study when we talk about Luke 17. The Bible Study, heard weekday mornings at 10:05. Join us.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Uwe Simonetto joins us here in just a moment. We're going to be talking to him in a little mini-religion roundup about liturgical reform. He has written a column called Reforming Liturgical Reform, and then we'll also talk about his latest on Islam. He's been writing a multi-part series on Islam for United Press International, and the latest, the ninth part, is Waiting for the Women in Islam. It's a subject that has been... Well, subjects that we've been talking quite a bit about here on Issues Etc., but it's also been reflected in the press. This is one of the things that people find ironic about Islam, is that, or at least ironic about the world's reactions to Islam. Being a woman in an Islamic state is not very pleasant. Now, it's said they have no rights but enormous power. What does that mean? Uwe will fill us in just a moment. Now, we've switched the lineup just a little bit from what I told you before, so I want to remind you, when we're done with Uwe, that'll be about 10, 15 minutes from now. Before we go to the top of the hour break, we're going to start open lines. I'd like to talk about the driving force of pop culture. It is imitation. Monkey see, monkey do. I want you to listen carefully before we go to that top of the hour break, and then be prepared to call afterwards for the remaining hour of open lines. Then we'll be talking with Dr. Ed Kettner about the social divide between our closest cousins to the north, Canadians, and we Americans. Dr. Daryl Charles rounds off our conversation in the last half hour of the program. We'll talk about just war theory. He's from Baylor University. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joins us from France. Uwe, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Nice to be back.
And Uwe's on his cell phone, so we might be getting a little bit of a delay, so we ask everyone to bear with us. When we talk about liturgical reform, what are we usually, what's usually meant by that, Uwe?
Well, in the past, liturgical reform used to be that people messed with traditional liturgy, but what is now going on in the Roman Catholic Church is that the Pope and Cardinal Ratzinger and others have called for a review of the reforms that date back to Vatican II 40 years ago, exactly 40 years ago on December 4th. And they realized that on the local level, the liturgy has always, often been trivialized. And the Romans, very much like certain types of liturgical Protestants, would like to return to the wealth and richness of traditional liturgy and the wonderful texts that biblical texts that you have in that.
And what is the Pope himself calling for by way of reviewing the changes that have taken place since Vatican II in the 60s?
Well, the Pope says that there have been, evidently, and this is what I'm reading out of this and what others are reading out of this, that there have been great abuses and that, that people should return to actual liturgy and not cook up their own liturgies as they go along. That is basically the concept. And it seems that there is a general movement afoot in the Catholic Church to return to that, including, by the way, turning towards the East in the church services, as we do in most of our churches as well. In other words, not the congregation worshiping itself.
Tell us.
And of course, another thing is, yes.
No, go ahead.
Yes, and then the other thing is, of course, that more use should be made of Latin again, which makes sense considering that this is a universal church, and the Latin texts are very are wonderful. The one thing they do not want, I mean, the one thing they give credit to the Protestant reformers to is that Protestantism has reoriented Rome to Scripture, so the Scripture lessons would obviously be continue to be in English or in the vernacular, but some of the liturgical elements should at times be in Latin again.
Uwe, you have written that in the four decades since Vatican II, much of the mysterious reality of the liturgy, this is the term used by the Pope when he wrote in commemorating Vatican II's constitution on the sacred liturgy, much of the mysterious reality of the liturgy has been experimented out of the divine service. You actually have a story to tell from last year's Good Friday service in La Rochelle, France. Tell us the story.
South of La Rochelle, this was the most horrible and horrible Good Friday service I've ever experienced. I went to the village church, and there they had a slideshow in the altar room. You know, other people on their knees and commemorating Christ's death on the cross, and here these guys have a slideshow, and a very banal one to boot. And it was so bad, and of course, since my wife and I stuck out as foreigners, Protestants, by the sheer look of it. We didn't walk out as we should have done, really, but we didn't want to offend the people who were very, very nice, and so we stuck it out, but it was actually nasty. And when I told my Catholic friends, they were horrified. Well, they said, this is the sort of thing that we experience rather frequently nowadays. It's sort of, you know, creative pastors. Who so like to invent their own church services, and let's have a slideshow on Good Friday. You know?
A slideshow on Good Friday is oddly reminiscent of what happens in a lot of our churches here Sunday after Sunday, Uwe.
Yeah, I know. I avoid them like the plague.
Uwe, let's talk a little bit about, by way of wrapping up this subject of liturgical reform, where is the Roman Catholic Church headed? Yeah. This pope would like to see some, not turning back the clock, but actually some rethinking of the revisions of Vatican II. But this pope is not likely to remain in office that much longer. Where are they headed?
Well, I wonder about that. I'll tell you what, from my talks with Roman Catholics, and I've just been traveling extensively around Europe and talking to Catholics a great deal, and very prominent Catholic leaders, they seem to continue along the lines. They are heavy on ecumenism now. The one thing they realize is that that with the secularization of Europe, plus, of course, radical Islam coming in here, there has to be a strong church. And I don't think that they will turn their back on that. There will be a heavy, heavy emphasis, from what I understand, on Christians working together to the utmost extent in re-evangelizing Europe and building Christianity back to its former strength here. I think that is very serious because looked at from our perspective here in Europe, and I've been now in four countries and talking to several other countries. I mean, I've been in France where I live, but I'm in Europe, and then, of course, Germany, which is my homeland, Belgium, and Switzerland. There is a growing awareness that what must happen is a refocusing these countries and these civilizations to the gospel. And there seems to be an opening. Of course, as you know, Europe ticks at a different speed than America does, but very often it goes very deep. So I discovered here a great deal of stuff that one doesn't hear when one is in the States, obviously, because you don't talk about it long. But for example, a fairly massive conversion of Muslims in Europe to Christianity. For example, every Easter night, in France alone, the Catholic Church alone, hundreds and hundreds of Muslims get baptized. And this does not include Protestant and evangelical churches, which also baptize Muslims, and it does not include congregations that are outwardly Muslim and secretly actually Christian.
We're talking with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. He joins us via cell phone from France. Along that line, the conversion of Muslims to Christianity, you quote very recently from a Reverend Hans Viking, saying that women in Islam are the greatest hope for the prospects of Muslim-Christian dialogue. Is this true?
Yes, absolutely. Muslim-Christian dialogue on a very very serious level. Fucking, who is a white father, these are and who taught and worked in Algeria for decades. White fathers are an order, a Catholic order, specializing in mission to Africa. He said, of course, there is Muslim men, and especially Muslim clerics, are not really interested in any form of dialogue with Christianity. On the other hand, the one way to come to terms with Muslims is via women, and the reason is the following. Women in Islam, as he says, have no rights. However, they have all the power in the family because they're the ones who are raising sons and who teach them religion. And there are women's groups, Catholic nuns, Protestant sisters. There's a big Protestant order, for a Lutheran order, working on this in Africa, and lay women who very intensively work together with Muslim women and have serious theological discussions, also correcting the errors in Islam about the mistaken thinking about Christianity. For example, as you know, the Quran claims that the Trinity consists of Father, Son, and the Virgin Mary, as opposed to the Holy Spirit, and that isn't explained properly. So these things, there is something going on here which we should be aware of and support in many ways. There's another interesting factor. I talked to a pastor in Germany who is baptizing Muslim women all the time, usually Persian women and refugees, but who actually came to Christ already back in Iran and then fled Iran and came over here. So it seems that this is the only current avenue in which to communicate with Muslims, other than, of course, westernized Muslims like here in France or in the United States who have an interest. But I'm now actually talking about the 99% of Muslims who live in Muslim countries rather than in Western countries.
Finally, Uwe, on the political front, is it likely that we will see women in Muslim countries gaining any kind of rights or prerogatives in countries like Saudi Arabia or Iran or Turkey?
Yes. Well, Turkey is already the case, of course, the prime minister. And of course, as you know, they had a woman prime minister in Pakistan. In Saudi Arabia, there, again, from what I hear and from studies that I've read, again, the women are making major inroads. To what extent they will reach positions of power, such as prime minister or ministers of something, I can't tell because it's hard to get in there. But you have Muslim countries where that has occurred. The main issue, however, is probably a very healthy one, that because women do have the power in the family and the family counts, and so therefore that is how they exercise their power over their offspring. And they need support in that, and I think this is happening right now.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you very much for joining us again on Issues Etc.
Thanks very much, Rod, and I hope next time around I'll have a landline again.
That'll be fine. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joined us via cell phone from France. For the remainder of this hour, open lines, and I'd like to talk about something. There are two things that have been rolling around in my head, and I finally realized late last evening and early this morning that I was actually thinking about the same thing, just from two different angles. Have you ever done this, where you've had problems you've tried to solve? Try this sometime. Instead of watching television or, yes, even opening a book or talking or remembering, try this. Just spend 10 minutes thinking. I'm not talking about remembering your childhood or emptying your mind. I'm talking about a question that has one of those things that rolls around and clatters around in the back of your mind that you've never had time or never taken the time to think about, and just think. You'll be amazed. Without the radio, without the television, without any other distractions, you might first discover how hard it is to keep up a line of thought for more than a few minutes without getting distracted by something. Washing dishes, it's a great one of those things, keep your hands busy and your mind active on something completely different. That way, yard work, one of those things that requires physical activity so that your mind is freed not to concern itself with what it's doing, but to think about other things. Think for 10 minutes. I've been trying to do this late at night, early in the morning, before the alarm clock goes off. I've been thinking about why it is that when I turn on TV or radio or go to the movies, there's nothing new. We saw a trailer for the new Peter Pan movie. You say, which Peter Pan movie? Well, I think it's about the fourth Peter Pan movie that's come out in the last 12 years. All purporting to tell the story of Peter Pan, the legendary happy little story of the boy from Never Never Land who could fly. Cat in the Hat. How the Grinch Stole Christmas. It seems as movie remakes. What was it? Ocean's 11, a remake of the original Ocean's 11. The Italian Job, a remake of the original. Yeah, the original Italian Job. It seems as though there's nothing original. Nothing. Then you turn on TV, and one show looks like another. There's a whole nightful every night of shows that you've all seen before. And I'm not talking about reruns. I'm talking about shows that are simply imitations of other shows. Last night, sitting with my wife during the last few minutes of Average Joe. Have you seen this show? Average Joe. I didn't have a hard time predicting what the outcome would be. And I can tell you why. It's not because I'm a genius or because I know women. Believe me, neither of those things are true. I didn't have a hard time predicting the outcome of Average Joe. Who would the girl pick? Beautiful girl had a choice between Average Joe and a guy who looked like he just walked off the set of soap opera. While I think my wife and daughter were sitting there on pins and needles wondering what she would do, I had no problem. Why? Because I'd seen it before. I think I saw this the last time I watched this show. No, this is the first time it's ever been on. Oh, well, then this is just like the show, right? Yes, it's exactly the same. It's not only reality shows, it's sitcoms, it's also makeover shows. Somebody has some success making a program where they make over an average-looking person into a slightly better-than-average-looking person, and suddenly everyone's doing it. Usually the last to catch on are the networks, and they usually do the cheesiest job. Friends. Last season of Friends, right? How many years have they been doing this? They've done every permutation you could possibly do. All of the girls, at least with the end of this final season, all of the girls will have had a baby, or two or three. They will have paired off in every pairing possible, except ones involving incest. And they've run out of things to do. I mean, how many more stories can you tell? The actors are getting paid $1 million an episode. They're bored doing the show. We're bored watching them. It's time for Friends to be over with, right? Remember when it debuted? Remember when Friends first came out and it was like, wow, this is a different kind of a sitcom. It's an ensemble cast. There's no real star. The only known actor there, nationally known actor, was Courtney Cox. And she was not really the star of the show. The stories were not written around her character. It was different. Second season of Friends. Everybody, every network was trying to do their version of Friends. It's an old joke that in Hollywood, producers don't have any original ideas. They just watch everyone else's network, see what works, and imitate it. They don't care why it works. All they care is that it works. If it's popular, if it sells, it must be good. The ancient Greeks taught that truth is beauty and beauty truth. If it is true, it will be beautiful. If it is beautiful, it must be true. We today have a similar take on truth, don't we? If it sells, it's true. If it's true, well, then it's going to sell. In fact, we're really not even care about the second part of that. Just if it sells, it's true. That's good enough for us today. Monkey see, monkey do. This is the driving force of pop culture. Imitation. I don't know if it always has been, although people looking out from the outside on American culture have been observing this. Alexis de Tocqueville observed this, that Americans don't have any original ideas. They just think they do. They just imitate what they see. And we've been borrowing in terms of pop culture from the Europeans since those four mop-topped boys stepped off the plane here and dislocated one of the only original artists we'd had, Elvis. He was gone. They were in. And from that point on, pretty much just a matter of one group imitating another, wasn't it? Why is it that all pop singers nowadays sound essentially the same? The women, they all sound essentially the same. Men, there are not many of them out there because no one has really broken out so they can be imitated. One boy band breaks big. The next thing you know, you've got 15 boy bands. Country music's no different. The driving force of pop culture is imitation. So we have Friends knockoffs. We have Survivor knockoffs. We have Joe Millionaire imitations. Everything on TV, everything that you see, for the most part, is a product of this. Imitation. Monkey see, monkey do. The same is true of radio. Rush Limbaugh started it all in 1988. Now there are more Rush Limbaugh imitators than can be counted. Monkey see, monkey do. That's how pop culture works. And actually, this has become the driving force behind most of everything. Not only culture, but politics, too. Howard Dean hits it big. Everyone else says, what's he doing? Let's find out what he's doing and saying, and let's do and say the same things. Now, sooner or later, we're going to have to differentiate one another from each other, but right now, let's do what works. Culture, politics, even the church, monkey see, monkey do. The church has become just another little monkey. It sees, and it does. Monkey doesn't think much, doesn't have to. All he has to do is see and do. If it sells, it must be good. If it's popular, it must be good. If everyone is doing it, then it must be good. We don't have to think about whether it's good. We don't have to think about why it may be good. We don't even have to think about why it works. All we care about is that it works. Monkey doesn't care much about why it works. Monkey's out for results. Not that different from the producers sitting in Hollywood without any original ideas, saying to themselves, look, instead of coming up with our own stuff for next year's lineup, let's just watch what the other guys are doing, what's getting the ratings, and let's just do that. When we come back, more open lines and more of Monkey See, Monkey Do.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.